So what do we accept for FT? Well, I think most theorists start to get uncomfortable if the fine-tuning is bigger than 10, which is to say that you would have to tune your parameters at scale lambda t to 10% or more precisely than that, you know, say 5% or, you know, some number, you know, more precise than 10%. So whereas, you know, theorists would like to say that this Higgs mass of 115 GeV is sort of completely natural, that no matter what parameter you choose at your scale lambda t, you're likely to get the right answer. Okay, well, if you accept that you don't want to go above FT of 10, then if you plug that in here, then what you get is something like 1 TeV as the maximum scale that you would allow for this problem to be fixed up at. Now, the issue that I wanted to address was the fact that if you add many Higgs fields instead of just having one Higgs field, then you can postpone this need for new physics by raising the scale lambda t. So one scenario that I and Espinosa explored early on was to add many singlets. I just said there might be many singlets. And what we want to do is imagine that these singlets mix with the standard model Higgs boson, which is a doublet or part of a doublet representation of the standard model group. And the only way that all these... So after this mixing, you just end up with a whole bunch of mass eigenstates. You might think, you know, 5 or 10 or more mass eigenstates. And each one of these, because of the mixing, the singlets don't couple directly to standard model particles because they're singlets, but after mixing, they do. And so each of these mass eigenstates will be some fractional component of the standard model Lagrangian field, plus all the other singlet fields that appeared in the Lagrangian. And of course, just by completeness, whatever the sum of the Fi squared must be equal to 1. So how does this help? Well, first of all, let's just remind ourselves that the precision electric weak data that we have likes to have an effective standard model Higgs at about 100 GeV. I'll come back to this. Or certainly not higher in mass than 170 GeV. Now, this model, that effective mass scale, is actually computed in the following way. The precision constraints basically depend upon the log of this electroweak scale. And in this type of model, that could be computed as the sum over Fi squared log of Mi, or another way of writing this formula is like that. So you can obtain an appropriate M electroweak of order 100 GeV in many ways. For example, you can have a mixture of small and large Mi with roughly equal Fi, and of course you have to be careful that you don't violate any left bounds. So if Mi is really much below 115 GeV, the current standard model less limit, then the Fi has to be fairly small. But there are all kinds of ways of escaping just the 115 GeV limit, because Higgs can decay into other Higgs, and the ZZ Higgs coupling of any one of these Higgs is reduced by that fraction Fi. And also the top anti-top coupling of any one of these Higgs is reduced by that same Fi. So instead of having the full top coupling here, you would have Fi times the top coupling. So what that means is that for any one Higgs, the fine-tuning measure is reduced by the fraction Fi squared here. And that means that if you're going to require, say, each Higgs Fti be below 10, well, that's going to be a lot easier to accomplish for a higher lambda t, right? So in fact, if you, for example, took one doublet plus four singlets, you can easily get lambda t up to 5 TeV without any problem, and obeying the left bounds and satisfying precision electroweak constraints and so forth. So it could be that if you believe supersymmetry in strings like a bunch of singlets, then maybe supersymmetry isn't required until 5 TeV, and you would then have to satisfy your hierarchy, you know, solve your hierarchy problem at 5 TeV, but you know, that would be an excuse why the LHC might not see supersymmetry when you thought it should, provided it had these extra Higgs. The problem is that these extra Higgs are pretty hard to detect because everybody has a reduced coupling to the standard Mollo coupling, so the production rates are changed, and the Higgs might decay to Higgs, so the LHC could really find this a very difficult Higgs detection scenario. The ILC at the linear collider, just to remind you, we have this wonderful possibility of having E plus E minus collisions. You measure the Z out here. This is the virtual Z. You look at this, let's say, at mu plus mu minus final state. So you can determine the mass of this missing state here with great accuracy because everything else is very well measured. So you can just do a plot of the cross-section d sigma d m sub x, where I'm just calling this missing state here x here. And if there is a Higgs resonance or any kind of resonance there, we would have to have ZZ coupling. Normally, if it were just a resonance, you would just get a nice peak there, and there wouldn't be any doubt as to what you have. Now, in this model, this peak might start to look like this, with a bunch of overlapping things, but the resolution is pretty good that they have to be strongly overlapping. And even if you had a continuum, you would know how to normalize, and you would know that you had an excess. So the linear collider
envelope on this continuum, or is it?
Yeah, well, there's different models for modeling all these Higgs, and in the very worst case, you just would describe it as an envelope of these peaks, but because of the precision electroweak constraint, you know that the weight of that envelope has to be sort of in the 100 GeV region. And if you put all that together, then you discover that yes, you could see even a continuum of Higgs with the worst possible weighting that you could imagine at the linear collider with enough luminosity. So this is not a low luminosity linear collider gain, but you have to have maybe 500 inverse picobarms integrated luminosity to be sure that you could see the worst possible continuum case. Yeah.
So I guess I'm a little skeptical that this the motivation for this is really to ameliorate the fine tuning, but I'm kind of skeptical about whether this large number of things really does that. And the reason is that for this thing to work, you need all of their masses to be around the weak scale. So presumably, in some more fundamental theory, there's a reason for that. So there's a reason why these guys are all at the weak scale, okay? And so that suggests that there should be some parameter in the fundamental theory that when you vary it, the masses of all these guys move together, up or down. And then if you do that, if you were to vary that parameter, if there was such a parameter, you would find that you were just as fine-tuned with respect to that parameter as you are here. In other words, you're only gaining because you're assuming that the measure of fine-tuning is just to vary them all independently. But there had to be some reason why they were all at the weak scale, not at the Planck scale or some other scale.
Well, let's imagine that one had this extra symmetry that might have started out with all these Higgs more or less massless plus one electroweak type Higgs at 100 GeV, okay, mm-hmm. or where you would like it to be at 100 GeV. So then you would, mix them all up, things would still be, sort of in the 100 GeV region, provided the breaking of this symmetry, whatever it was, wasn't very strong, right?
Well, somehow you need a mass matrix with rank much bigger, with rank n, where n is the number of these things.
Yes, right.
Why are all the eigenvalues of that mass matrix the same? I mean, there should be some reason, but then if you vary the parameter that changes the overall mass scale, you would be varying them all at the same time, and then you wouldn't get to, divide
each. But that last part, I agree, you have to have the right mass matrix structure, and that you could regard as some kind of fine-tuned assumption if you wanted to. But
no, but that's not.
But
you can
okay,
have some symmetry
so,
that does
okay,
that.
But if
I'm
you,
saying you have a parameter
right,
that controls
each,
the overall
but each
mass,
Higgs
yeah.
mass is being controlled by Fi squared times the usual.
Right, but then Fi is of order 1 over root n.
Right.
Because if they're all equally mixed. so fi squared is order 1 over n, but you have n of those. So if you're varying
but,
them
but
all
I
the
haven't
same
pushed
time,
any of them up above 100 GeV significantly unless lambda t goes to 5 TeV in my example.
Well, maybe we should test this later.
There's definitely an assumption that I have the right kind of mass matrix that establishes this mixing. But I think given that, the rest is okay. Now, you'll notice that I'm focusing on doublets and singlets. I just want to remind you that's good in the phenomenological sense that the W to Z mass ratio, which is supposed to be a nice prediction of the doublet-type theory, is retained even if you add singlets, but it's not retained if you add triplets, especially if those triplets have a non-zero BEV for the mutual member of the triplet representation. I won't come back to this. I'm going to throw away triplets, in other words, and not worry further about them. Now, in these kind of models, multi-Higgs models such as I'm discussing are always going to give you trilinear Higgs self-coupling. So, it's not going to be a single Higgs, but there'll be, things like, say, H1 coupled to Higgs number 2 and so forth. There'll be lots of trilinear Higgs couplings. And these are particularly dangerous in a certain sense that I'm going to specify. And the reason they're dangerous is that you are very likely to get a strong branching ratio for Higgs to Higgs pair decays, especially if the mass of the decaying Higgs is below the 2W threshold. Above the 2W threshold, then that turns on very rapidly and gives you a large partial width in that channel. But if it's phase space disallowed, then here's the comparison. So it's conventional to write the Higgs 2 to Higgs 1 coupling that I illustrated over there as some constant C times this function of the heavier Higgs mass squared. So if you then just put that in temporarily into the width formula for H2 to H1, you get a value like this, 0.17 times this constant squared, that's not the speed of light, by the way, times that MH2 over 100 GeV cube. Notice the cube. It means that this is a big width. And you should compare that to the normal Higgs to BB bar branching ratio. This is the standard model branching ratio of 0.003 times the Higgs over 100 GeV, which is only linear. So it doesn't take much C to have this mode dominate over the usual BB bar mode. And even if the W and Z channels are open, this number that you get here is the same as this number that you have here. So if C is not too small, it's actually competing even with the usual WW and ZZ modes. So just some examples. If C is 0.13, then the Higgs and BB bar branching ratios are the same. If it's 0.42, then this Higgs partial width is 10 times the BB bar partial width. Now, largish values for C are pretty common in models that you write down, and one finds that typically the Higgs pair modes are very likely to dominate until one gets above the WW threshold. I mean, this is something that Haber and I first noticed way back when we were exploring one of the first explorations of the next minimal supersymmetric model, and since then many people have rediscovered this fact. So, why is this important? Well, a particularly attractive setup, as I'm about to come to, is to have 100 GeV Higgs that has, more or less standard model strength, but have it such that it decays to two light Higgs bosons, and these light Higgs bosons, as we'll discuss, should be quite light, namely have masses below 2 MeV. So why would we want such a scenario? Well, first of all, precision electron weak, I'll remind you of this graph, which is a more precise statement of what I gave before. It's actually out of date now. This thing has actually moved down some. Requires, or certainly prefers, a standard model like Higgs or collection of Higgses in the 100 GeV range. And that gives you, very excellent agreement with all the precision data for LEP measurements of W's and Z's and other such things. So that's really very statistically powerful and undoubted result. Now there's another less statistically significant, by that I mean a 2.3 statistical significance result that comes from the old LEP data, which says that at 98 GeV, which is certainly close enough to 100, that there was an excess of events that could not be explained by the background. Now I won't go into what this 1 minus CLV is, but anyway, this dip says that there was an excess of events at this statistical significance at a price at precisely 100 GeV.
Now that BB bar?
Yeah, so this is in the standard, the set of all channels. You know, they put it, everything they put together, right, in the final analysis.
Sorry, this. Okay.
So this is just from standard left combined left weak.
Standard model search.
Yeah, so this is the standard model search, but this is, how consistent is what you see with background? So that's, this B just means background only. So there's a problem here, that results weren't very consistent with background at this point.
Is there a statement about what class of events, what mode contributed mainly to that peak? Is it dominated by one particular
state? Well, it's certainly dominated by BB bar,
BB bar,
Higgs contained to BB bar.
Right. So, but then, and Z going to,
Z goes to all kinds of things. Leptons and jets and missing and neutrinos. They try to put all the channels
together.
So
there are some excess BB bar events.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's important to consider though that when you can interpret this plot, an excess like that could have occurred at any. Is this bunk hunting factor?
Of course, right. I agree. Yes, I know. That's why 2.3 sigma is, that's not a strong discovery by any means, but it's there. And of course, in the standard model, we sort of ignore this dip because we say, if it had been a standard model, the Higgs would be decaying very strongly to BB bar, and you should have had something in this green band, and this dip is nowhere near this green band, right? However, if I reduce the BB bar branching ratio to 1/10 its standard model, then this green band goes straight through that dip, And that's what I'm going to do, because I'm going to say that Higgs, instead of decaying mainly to BB bar, actually mainly decays to other Higgs bosons that are lighter. And not only that, those Higgs bosons have to be lighter than 2MB, because otherwise, this channel would have populated the 4B final state, for which LEP also has strong constraints. So the model that would make these two things consistent with one another in the Higgs interpretation of this dip has to have an H1 that decays either to 2 taus or 2 jets, or in some extreme, 2 leptons. H1 cannot be a pure singlet. First of all, it wouldn't give this bump here, but also there are very strong constraints on H1 going into invisible. A singlet, if it were purely singlet, would be totally invisible to the detector. And this actually is an easily analyzed channel at LEP, and the limit there is H2 should be heavier than 114 GeV. So you don't want a pure singlet, you just want a sort of partial singlet. In order to make all this fit together. So the bottom line at the moment is that you might want to look for an H1 with mass below 2MB with some coupling to BB bar, however this H1 would decay because of this mass to mainly 2 taus or 2 jets or other things. And this is why one starts to think about B-factory searches, because B-factories are typically operating right near the total energy of 2MB, a little bit below, but close enough that you can cover a lot of this scenario, and it's only a matter of how big is the coupling to BB bar as to whether or not you can see this weakly coupled light Higgs in these upsilon decays. So I'll come back to more detailed discussion of that. Anyway, first of all, let's just look at some non-SUSY sample models. For example, let's take a two-doublet model. And, you know, normally what one, well, there's some general potential for this two-doublet models. And if you look at this potential and diagonalize everything, you discover that you have two CP even Higgs bosons, the heavier guy and the lighter guy. And there's also a CP odd Higgs boson in this model. Now, normally, you know, one thinks of what's called the decoupling limit, where you take the mass of the CP odd Higgs boson to be very large, and in that case, the little h naught becomes very standard model-like, and you can't really tell that this isn't just a simple standard model Higgs boson very easily. But that's, you know, just in this general context, just one possibility. If you sort of take a more specialized form of the potential, which some of us looked at one point, then what one discovers is that the h plus or minus in h naught Higgs masses squared can be large, you know, proportional to this, and there'll be a standard model-like guy with a lower mass, and then all of these Higgs bosons will be heavier than the A. So for some simple form of the potential, kind of an attractive form in some sense, if you take lambda 5 much bigger than lambda 1, then indeed the A can be very light below 2MB. H naught to A naught, A naught to K's are in fact really dominant. In fact, this is too good because I don't get that nice little 2.3 sigma thing because I overdid it in this model. But it just shows you that you can easily write down a doublet model that has a light pseudoscalar that you know, might give you real problems at the LHC. There's another limit, but this has other problems, so I'm not going to discuss it. Now, this has been also pursued recently by Barbieri and Hall, who sort of, you know, looked at this electron weak game in just the two doublet context and sort of came to the same conclusion that Espinosa and I did in the singlet context, that you can, you know, delay the hierarchy and naturalness problems, but you have to put up with Higgs pair decays. But in their model, the lighter Higgs is too heavy to appear in upsilon decays, and you know, they don't care about that 2.3 sigma dip in that one graph. If you think of a single doublet plus one singlet, so that's another. Previously, I was talking about two doublets. Here's a single doublet plus one singlet. So in this case, we'll have a, you know, possibly a light CP odd Higgs boson, maybe a light CP even Higgs boson, and maybe a singlet Higgs boson. And these guys might mix. There'll be a Higgs singlet Higgs field and a doublet Higgs field. So let's just try to understand what can happen in this model. So the most general Lagrangian that you can write down, or potential that you can write down, I should say, is this. The Higgs doublet field is required to have the usual Bev squared. Then there's a mass term for the singlet field. There's a quadratic term that has interactions between the singlet field and the doublet field. There's self-interactions in the singlet field. And these are all even in the singlet field S, and then there are possible terms that are odd in the singlet field S that look like this. Now, you can throw away those last terms on the second line if you ad hoc, you know, there's no particularly good reason for doing this, but there's no particularly good reason for not doing it. So you could impose what's called a C2 symmetry of the potential under S goes to minus S, and then you would erase all those fields. So let's just think about the possibility here. You'll get a better idea for what I'm talking about. Now, if you impose this Z2 and MS squared here is positive, then the singlet field has zero expectation value, zero vacuum expectation value. And in that case, if you just look at what can happen up here, there is no SH mixing term. You know, where would it come from? Well, it might come from here, but I've got to give both one of these S's of Ev and one of the H's of Ev in order to get such a mixing term. Okay, but I'm considering the limit in which I don't have a BEV for the single. So the best you can do is put a BEV here or here, and then you'll get an HS squared. So I'll have my Higgs trilinear coupling, but I will not have the Higgs mixing. So what this will mean is that the quantum degree of freedom, which I call little s here, will be absolutely an absolutely stable particle, and Murray Halla in their nearly minimal supersymmetric model will sort of employ this idea to say maybe this is a good dark matter candidate.
Okay. Would it have to be over 100 GeV then?
Not necessarily. It would.
A cold dark matter favors.
Yeah, but there are various annihilation channels that, you know, especially this Higgs. Remember that you have this HS squared coupling here, so just a question of what the value of this K is. You know, if it's strong enough, then you can do anything you want. Okay, well, anyway, that's not the kind of thing that I'm interested in. but anyway, you know, as I said, if you just look at that K term that has the H dagger HS squared, put a BEV in one of these places, you get the HS squared coupling that would give you H into SS decays. This would give you, mean that the normal Higgs would be invisible, and you would have the normal limits on this. Now, of course, there are additional new physics that you can add in that would make the S unstable. There's this model that Fox and Weiner concern where they added in some heavy vector-like quarks, they put a loop diagram in, and then we discovered the pseudoscalar, their models, or the S is actually pseudoscalar A, would then decay to two photons or two gluons via the loop diagram with some, you know, quite small branching ratio. actually, those should be widths, and the decay lifetime could be long when you would get displaced vertices. However, even if this singlet is light, a B factory is not useful since there's no A to BB bar coupling. It's still a pure singlet guy. It happens to have these couplings to some super heavy vector-like quark family, but that doesn't mean it has BB bar couplings. So that's one possible limit of that potential that's not of interest to a B factory, but in all other cases, something could be interesting there. So if you don't impose the Z2 and or MS squared is less than zero, then in general you're going to get some HS type mixing. So for example, if MS squared is less than zero, then the singlet field will acquire a BEV, and so there'll be a possibility of putting a BEV here and a BEV there, and then you'll get HS mixing. Or if I don't impose the Z2 symmetry, then this term here is allowed. I put a BEV here or here, and then I get HS mixing. So there are more ways of getting HS mixing out of such a general potential than there are of avoiding it. So anyway, you know, there's certainly possibilities like this from the K term to give you HS mixing. X here is the BEV of the singlet, and of course, going along with that is the HS squared trilinear Higgs coupling that would lead to Higgs decays to two, you know, sort of singlet guys, although now we would have the mixing, so H and S themselves would not actually be eigenstates. They'd actually be diagonalized. Okay, so what can you do with such a model? There's actually more than one attractive possibilities. One case is that you could, after doing the mixing, you have these two eigenstates. S mix has BB bar couplings and BB bar decays that might dominate if they're kinematically allowed. So one thing you could do is choose your eigenstates so that the H mix, which is mainly standard model light, mainly not standard model light, is at 98 GeV, and the S mix, which is mainly standard model-like, is at 115 GeV. So you would choose the coupling so that the H mix decayed to BB bar with and multiply that branching ratio, multiply by the coupling, the H mixed to ZZ squared, would agree with that 2.3 sigma excess. So in other words, you would want this product to be 0.1. And then the mainly standard model S mix at 115 GeV, you would ask that this same kind of product, except this should be H, that should be S mix, sorry, that should be S mix, should be about 0.9, and you know that there was some left excess also at 115 GeV, very marginal, even more marginal than the 2.3 sigma in the end. But, you know, if you wanted to explain both those excesses, you can do it in this model. Okay, but it's not interesting for B factors. if S mix were mainly singlet and smaller than 2 MB, then you would be back to that scenario that I described where, you know, you would put the H mix standard model like guy at 100 GeV, have it decay mainly to two S mixes, and that's easily arranged, and you would set the product here to 0.1 so that you explain the 2.3 sigma excess. Okay, so the bottom line is that even outside a superstring or supersymmetry context, there's, you know, some general theoretical and model building motivation for light Higgs bosons, and you can set up a bunch of, you know, rather interesting scenarios. If these H, capital H to HH decays here, you change my notation to some sort of more general thing. This capital H is standard model-like, and these little H's are, you know, sort of weakly coupled guys. This is pretty hard to see at a hadron collider. Nobody has shown yet that you can actually see such a mode at a hadron collider. And meanwhile, these decays destroy all the other modes that people have thought about for seeing a Higgs boson at a hadron collider. So if that continues to be the case, you might have to wait for the linear collider, and as I said, use this missing mass technique to see this bump. There would only be one over here, hopefully. Best case, there would only be one. You would find the capital H here, but, you know, nowadays we think this might not happen until 2020-something, 23, 24, 25.
Well, in this scenario, we wouldn't have seen it at the LHC.
That's right. So you wouldn't have seen it at the LHC. The chances of Congress giving you the money to do this are probably minimal anyway. So that's exactly right. And, of course, there might be other H's that don't appear in Higgs decays. They still might have BB bar coupling, and you'd still like to search for them in upsilon decays. And, you know, for those kinds of Higgs that don't have much BB bar coupling or don't appear in Higgs decays, it might be the B factory is our only chance to ever find them. So this is, you know, this talk, of course, was given to the Bogart collaboration where I was trying to get them to do some running on what's called the upsilon 3S, where they would have a lot of sensitivity to this kind of decay, just as it's just, I believe, of value to the high-energy field because, you know, they might actually see something. And if they don't, then that will place some very strong limits. You wouldn't want to have a string theory that had 20 of these little H's that could have been seen in upsilon decays and just were never looked for, right? If you didn't see them and you didn't know where they were there, you would never really understand your superstring vacuum or whatever it was that gave rise to this scenario. But of course, you know, you have to go down to quite small branching ratios in order to really do a valuable search. Now, what would happen at the LHC is that, as we said, you don't see this capital H because it's decaying to two lighter Higgs, but we would be able to kind of know something was there because we would look at WW scattering and discover that it was nice and perturbative. This takes quite a bit of luminosity to do this, but eventually we would know whether or not WW scattering was perturbative of the LHC. And if it was, just nice, simple, perturbative, no extra strong longitudinal W scattering or anything like that. And if we didn't see any extra dimensions, we would say, okay, well, the only choice is a Higgs. Okay, it's got to be there, even if we can't see it. But again, would the Congress give us money to build an ILC in order to see this guy that we can only infer is there. Well, again, pretty unlikely.
But, okay, sorry, back for a second. If, but you could see it as a B-fact in that case.
You might see the light Higgs in the B-factor, yeah. So if it gave that 2.3 sigma effect, then that actually, as I'll discuss now, actually means that there would be enough BB bar coupling to see it in upsilon decays if they could probe deep enough in the branching ratio. Okay, so that story is only completely worked out in the next to minimal supersymmetric model. So now I'm going to turn to supersymmetry. In supersymmetry, there are two superfields associated with the two doublets of Higgs bosons that are needed. You need two Higgs superfields, each one of which has a doublet scalar component to it. And in this case, that would define the minimal supersymmetric model, and then the next minimal supersymmetric model adds to this structure here an additional singlet superfield that's denoted by this capital S. And then if you analyze the degrees of freedom, you discover that you end up with three CP even Higgs bosons that are just labeled in order of increasing mass, and two CP odd Higgs bosons. Now, why would you focus on SUSY, and in particular on the NMSSM model? Well, as we said, if you just have Higgs-only models, all you can do is to delay your naturalness problems to, you know, 5 or 10 TeV. You still have a quadratic divergence, and eventually it's going to catch up to you. So if you're going to have SUSY at some level, why not have it at the earliest possible level so I don't have to, you know, have some crazy model with lots of Higgs bosons? That's what most people would say, in fact. And so if you adopt that point of view, SUSY remains the most attractive way to completely solve this quadratic divergence problems. Further, you know, SUSY has some really attractive features that some of you know about, and some of you will eventually learn about. If you have exactly two doublets, and of course any number of singlets, because they just never influence anything, then what you discover is you get gauge coupling unification. Gauge couplings are not constants. They evolve, and the prediction within supersymmetry is that they all converge and unify at a certain point, at 10 to the 16th GeV or somewhat above. And if you don't have SUSY and you only have the standard model, you would discover that you don't get this gauge coupling unification. So supersymmetry with the exactly, and not anymore, two Higgs doublets gives you exactly this coupling constant unification to within 1% or something like that. And, you know, most of us say, well, this can't be an accident, okay? You can't rule out it as being an accident, but, you know, something like that is really striking. The other thing is that the renormalization group evolution equations for the soft Higgs masses squared, these are SUSY breaking parameters, are such that Higgs mass squared for the up-type Higgs field that couples the top, you know, because this coupling is really quite strong, what you discover is that becomes negative. It evolves, if it starts at a positive mass squared at the gut scale, then it evolves to a negative mass squared at low energy scales, and that's that negative mass squared that causes the symmetry to break and gives the Higgs field a vacuum expectation value. So you either know that story or you don't, but I'm just saying these two things are regarded as extremely attractive features of supersymmetry and really are the reason why we take it so seriously. Now, what about the NMSSM? Well, the NMSSM still has those properties. It doesn't change either of those two things, but it has some other problems, some other good properties that are solving MSSM problems. The main one is the new problem. In the MSSM, you have to have a superpotential term that looks like this. It's sort of bilinear in the two Higgs superfields, and that new parameter is dimensionful, which is unlike any other parameter in the superpotential. All the others are dimensionless. So one immediately asks, why should this be of order of TeV, which is required for, you know, proper electroweak symmetry breaking and, you know, proper Higgs mass spectrum and various other regions? You know, why should it be of order of TeV rather than zero, which is ruled out by having too light a chargino, or order mu or m Planck. Yeah, there's no reason for it to, you know, just sit in this nice TEV range where we need it. The theory, you have to do something special in the theory in order to get that. In fact, you know, people have written down oodles of, you know, possible models for getting it, but none of them is, at least in my opinion, particularly convincing. And whenever you have 10 explanations for something, you know that probably none of them are right. Whereas the NMSSM, this becomes extremely simple. Instead of this superpotential term here, you write down one that's trilinear in the singlet HU and HD superfields with a dimensionless parameter lambda. Then the new parameter is automatically generated when the scalar component of this S acquires the vacuum expectation value. So the effective value of the new parameter is lambda times that BEV. And the only requirement is that the BEV be of order, you know, TEV or, you know, something of that order, and then everything works. And this turns out to be almost automatically the case, that you get the right scale for that BEV, because that BEV is controlled by supersymmetry breaking, which you're going to put at a TEV anyway in order to solve the naturalness problem. Now, there are other terms in the superpotential. In particular, there's what are called these soft supersymmetry breaking terms that have S cubed, that's the scalar field only now, times kappa, A kappa, and the trilinear scalar field coupling, which is proportional A lambda. So, as I say, in this model, all the superpotential parameters are dimensionless, and it's the Susi breaking TEV scale that sets the scale of everything, and everything just works beautifully. Okay, now comes another fine-tuning argument. Also creates a problem for low-scale supersymmetry. I see I'm going to run out of time for this talk.
You have until 6 o'clock, right?
Not
that long.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
Now,
John's looking at me like,
yeah, right.
Don't get a joke about that.
It could happen if you, I'm not careful. So we had, you know, the hierarchy problem. The next level of fine tuning that one has to worry about, it's not disconnected from this one, but it's not the same either, is the fact that mz squared in the minimal supersymmetric model can be very sensitive to the gut scale parameter. So remember what happens. You start off with this Higgs mass squared at some high scale, it evolves to a negative value, the VEV turns on, and the Z boson acquires mass. But you're starting at some gut scale at, you know, a few times 10 to the 16th GeV, evolving down you know, this mass squared that you set up there to some, you know, appropriate value at low scale, and you've got to get not just any old number, you've got to get mz squared for your Z mass. So how likely is that to happen? Well, the answer is that if though that Higgs mass squared at the gut scale is kind of big, this isn't very likely. In other words, if supersymmetry breaking parameters are large, this mz squared result is going to be very problematical. So in order to avoid that kind of fine tuning, you need, turns out, a fairly light Polino. I don't have time to go into why that is, but in particular, also light stops are the partners of the top quarks. It's those partners that cure this quadratic divergence, okay? So the problem is that if the stops are too light, then the Higgs mass squared, which is in the MSSM, you know, very definite computation, including the top loop and stop loop effects, comes out looking like this. And what you've got to do is get this thing up to 114 GeV, whereas the natural value at tree level is 91. So you can do it, but what happens is that in order to do that, this the root mean square of this product of stop masses here has to be bigger than a TeV, and then you're in that FT bigger than 10 situation that we didn't like. So you're going into another kind of fine-tuning. The analog of FT is, in fact, you know, quite big if you just do it in this simple way. Now, the NMSSM avoids this. Why? Well, because I can have 100 GeV Higgs. It'll be decaying to two light pseudoscalars in this model, And the left signal will, all left data will be consistent provided that light's pseudoscalar is less massive than 2MD. And of course, this kind of model is really very common in string models. You know, strings like supersymmetry, so that's good. And they like these extra singlet superfields, so that's good. And so, in fact, this NMSSM is just probably the simplest of a much larger class of models that will operate in a similar way. So a rigorous measure of fine-tuning is again, one of these log derivatives where P here is any gut scale parameter. And there are a bunch of them. I've only mentioned a few of them, you know, the stop mass at the gut scale, the Higgs mass at the gut scale, and so forth and so on. You have to check that you're not overly sensitive to any of them. If F is bigger than 20, this is really bad. That, you know, we just don't think that's a sensible model. We would like to have F less than 10. And there's no way in the MSSM, the best you can do in a very specialized scenario in the MSSM to get is to get F of around 15. And this requires a very precisely adjusted value for the stop mixing parameter A sub T that some of you know about. In contrast, in the NMSSM, we can get F of 5, which really means that's probably the best you can ever do. In any model, it would never be better than that. And this happens if the H1 is standard model-like and the Higgs mass is 100 GeV. That's sort of just a natural prediction because you're starting even in the NMSM with something like 91, and it's just natural to add not too much to that and get something like 100 GeV. And in fact, here's a plot of that MZ-type fine-tuning versus the Higgs mass in the NMSSM for some parameter choices. And the points that evade all experimental constraints are these yellow cross points. And you can see that to get this fine-tuning of 5, you don't have just any old Higgs boson mass. You have 100 GeV or something very close to that. So that's another, in this context, that's a reason why you would expect, in fact, a Higgs mass of 100 GeV, and then it's just a question of whether the model can make that acceptable or even good. As we've argued, it could be good if the Higgs to dB R branching ratio is 1/10 the normal value. Then you explain the 2.3 sigma effect, you still have the precision like the weak, and so forth. For this Higgs mass, at low energies, the square root of this product of stop mass is about 350 GeV. These would be very easily seen with LHC, but are sort of just outside the range of the Tevatron. Probably can't quite get there. I don't know, maybe John has some inside information, but anyway, it's hard, I think. So it's just right there. Haven't quite gotten there, and it'll probably require the LHC. So, but we do require this light MA. So that brings up yet another fine-tuning issue. Is a light A1 natural? Is to get a light A1 an unnatural situation in the context of this model as a function of the gut scale parameters, or is it a natural situation? So, of course, we explored that. So the A1 properties depend primarily on these soft SUSY breaking parameters that I mentioned, A kappa and A lambda. And if these are exactly zero at scale MZ, then in fact the branching ratio for Higgs to A1 to A1 is not as big as we needed. We needed roughly bigger than 0.7 in order to reduce the BB bar branching ratio below 0.2 and to allow 100 GeV guy to escape left limits. However, a more reasonable model assumption is to set these guys to zero at the gut scale. That's sort of where boundary conditions should be simple. And that's kind of a symmetry limit to the model. Then if you just use the R renormalization group equations to evolve down to low scale, then you get numbers of order 100 GeV for A lambda and for the order a few GeV for A kappa. And it turns out this is just what the doctor ordered. Okay, this a large fraction of these scenarios give you exactly what you want. Another thing that happens is that you discover that in order to get this branching ratio to the bigger 0.7, all the model choices that do that have a lower bound on the fraction of MSSM CPI guy And that lower bound is very important, as we're going to see. So it has to have some doublet mixture in order to give that branching ratio in the region that we wanted in order for all this to work and left constraints to be avoided. So we constructed a measure called G of this fine tuning, and I'll just show you G, a plot of G here. So here's G, you know, we want something, you know, down below, say 10 or something like that. And what you'll see is that there are a bunch of green, black, and red points, all of which sort of populate this minus 0.1 region in this non-single fraction of the Higgs boson light pseudoscalar. The different colors indicate different masses. If the pseudoscalar is lighter than 2m tau, it's hard to get really good values for the G. But if it's bigger than 2m tau, then you know, small g is definitely possible. So that's why eventually I'm going to say you want to search for, you know, epsilon to photon plus pseudoscalar, where the pseudoscalar decays to 2 taus. That's sort of the primary channel of interest to a B factor. Okay, so I don't have time for all this summary. This talk is posted on my webpage if you want to look at it. So, you know, we want to push epsilon to gamma A1 decays to the limit. And how far is that limit? Well, you have to go and compute epsilon to gamma A1 in this model. There's a so-called famous Wilczek formula that gives you the tree-level result, and you have to add QCD radiated corrections, bound state corrections, relativistic corrections. This is a long, long story that was first explored back in the 80s when they thought they saw a resonance in epsilon to photon plus Higgs at 8.3 GeV. Eventually that went away in a statistical fashion, but you know, one could say, well, maybe they were just lucky with those first events and there really is some guy there, just they haven't pushed it down to the level where they can really see it in a significant way. Aside from all those corrections, if you want to compute the branching ratio for the A1 or the R value, what one actually does is to measure this ratio of gamma A to mu plus mu minus to k-width, the relative branching ratio. That's suppressed compared to an A that has sort of maximal coupling to standard model length in a certain language by a factor of cosine theta A, which we had a lower bound on in tangent beta, gets multiplied in there, and tangent beta might be 3 or 50. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities. So here's the resulting plot, epsilon to gamma A1. The color coding is the same as before. Remember, you want to be sort of the cosine theta A of minus 0.1 to get low fine tuning for the A1 properties. And you can see that depending upon your mass, you have quite small branching ratios, 10 to the minus 5, you know, maybe 10 to the minus 4. This is another, all of these points here have you know, fine tuning in the Z sense, MZ fine tuning, that's below 12 or 15, I can't remember. But anyway, very low Z scale fine tuning. So you're definitely in this, you know, sort of zone 10 to the minus 5 and below if you really want to probe the most attractive parameter sets for the model. If you change tangent beta, tangent beta equal 3, all these things move down, you know, 10 to the minus 7 and below could even be relevant. If tangent beta is 50, then things move up and life is a little bit easier. So, you know, the question is, how well can you do? Well, that's sort of a story that I'm not going to go into experimentally. I thought I downloaded, there's a graph that I wanted to show you. Somehow my download did not take hold. Well, if I come back to this plot here, you know, there's some Clio 3 data that they've now analyzed that constrains, you know, some, as a function of the pseudoscalar mass, which is the color coding here, you know, puts a limit on this branching ratio depending upon that mass that lies somewhere between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 5. If for those scenarios with the pseudoscalar heavier than 2m tau, so it's decaying to 2 taus. So, you know, some fraction of these red points are ruled out by the latest Clio data, but there's obviously lots of room in this model to avoid even those Clio bounds, and so one really wants to try to persuade the B factories to, you know, sit on one of these upswing resonances and try to push this as low as they can go. How low they can go hasn't really been determined. You know, they have to study their backgrounds and their triggering and their systematics and all these good things before they can say how long they should run on the epsilon to achieve the best result that they can. There's going to be some lower limit they just can't go below, and it's not known what that is without further study. Okay, so of course there's always a region where the A1, you know, could lie between 2MB and the mass of whatever upswing you're using, and that would still allow this scenario, but that, you know, it's not a very big region. You know, you'd have to be kind of unlucky if the MA sat in that little gap, if you wish. So anyway, we want to, you know, hopefully push the upswing branching ratios down to 10 to the minus 7 to get the B factories to explore this area. And if they do, they might well discover the A1, and that would certainly be a major deal. So anyway, just to conclude, not too late, the NMSSM can naturally have small fine tuning with respect. To gut scale parameters for everything you want. With respect to electroweak symmetry breaking, that is getting the right value of mz squared. With respect also, of course, to curing the naturalness and hierarchy problem if the SUSY is at the 1 TeV or below level. And you can also naturally have this light A1 scenario in this model as well. If you have that cosine theta A, the mixing with the MSSMA in the sort of minus 0.1 region. And as I've said, you know, there are, you know, substantial number of parameter choices that do that. It's not such a hard deal. So if low electroweak symmetry breaking and other fine tunings are imposed for an acceptable SUSY model, we should expect this 100 GeV guy decaying to two light pseudoscalars with MA less than 2 MB, the A1 is mainly singlet. So what are the collider implications going to be once again? This is a real troublesome scenario for a hadron collider such as the LHC, although I'm working with some people where we may have a result that says it can be done, but with lots of luminosities using what's called diffractive Higgs production. Higgs detection at the ILC will be extremely straightforward using this missing mass peak that is in back of me here, no problem whatsoever, but that might be 2023 or some such year as that. I'll be long gone. There might be a possibility. There might be a possibility of using photon collisions to make the H1, and if this, a low energy, this doesn't require a huge energy photon collider, 100 GeV, of course, you know, maybe given how long the ILC is being delayed, you know, maybe one should think seriously about building something that would collide two photons with very high luminosity, of course, and then you would be able to see these A1 decays without too much problem. But another hope is this upswing decays, and that would be very helpful. Of course, the LHC will see lots of supersymmetry in this scenario. Stops are light. Everything should be light to avoid fine-tuning for this MZ, value of MZ at low energy. But even if the LHC sees all the supersymmetry, and even if it sees this H1 to A1 directly, let's get really optimistic, you're not going to get much detail at the LHC from this, and only the ILC or possibly B factory results would give you details of the H1 of the A1 properties and also the H1 to A1 coupling that you would like to have that would allow you to really figure out what the model is and so forth. As I said, there are many other models where the new parameter is generated, like the MSSM. And, you know, there are more Higgs fields. Sometimes they're charged under some U1 that's not a standard model U1, but some other U1. And life can get much more complicated and still solve all the new parameter problems. But all of them will have a Higgs around 100 GeV, and that will only escape, you know, in order to avoid fine-tuning, and that will only escape left limits if it's decaying to, you know, some pseudoscalar or set of pseudoscalars so that you escape left limits. So in general, the A1, you know, might be more or less singleton in the NMSSM, but, you know, again, you would hopefully be able to probe it with these upstream decays. So as I've already said, the ability to test perturbativity of WW into WW scattering, you know, is very crucial. Even if you see all the supersymmetry, you still, you know, don't know whether there is or isn't a Higgs possibly present. But if you see supersymmetry and WW scattering is perturbative, then that is just a, you know, almost an ironclad argument for a, you know, sort of 100 GeV Higgs decaying in some strange way. Now, another issue here is it might be that this light A1 is coupled with an unusual neutralino. Because we have a singlet in this model neutralino, it could be that that singlet neutralino is very light. And so dark matter, you know, might only be, you know, 500 MeV or GeV or 2 GeV or something like that. How would you annihilate enough of this in the early universe? Well, you use the A1 because it's sitting there right where you want it, you know, 2 GeV or, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 GeV. The annihilation in the early universe goes through that mode. And, of course, you'd like to check that you get the right dark matter density. How do you do that? Well, you've got to know the A1 mass, you've got to know its couplings, you've got to know a lot about the A1, and also a lot about the neutralino as well. And only then can you perform the dark matter calculation. And, you know, an ILC, you know, can probably get all the information you need, but the Upsilon decay would help tremendously. If you had that information, then you could make progress. So anyway, you need large B-factory data sets. At Bob R, you would probably run at the 3S. You might look directly for gamma A, or you might trigger on the 1S by looking at the dipi on decay mode of the 3S down to the 1S. That's a good way to get rid of backgrounds. That might be the way they would actually do it, but they have to study it. You know, what are the limits? Well, there's some discussion here. But the bottom line is that if you want to get below 10 to the minus 6 or so using this 3S mode, sorry, here's where I want to do, you want to get to 10 to the minus 6 using the 3S mode, you would need to collect something like 5 inverse femtobarns over your efficiencies for cuts and so forth and so on. And that would require about a month running at the Babar facility at SLAC. How much does a month cost? It costs $2 million to run it a month on the 3S. But nobody has $2 million, so this may not even happen. Okay.
Have a bake sale.
Have a bake sale or something, right? So I don't know whether they're going to do this, but, you know, I think they've gotten interested. I've gotten some traction down there at Slack by giving this talk, so, you know, maybe...
It's hard for them, right, to retune the interaction?
No, 3S they ran on very successfully.
But
1S... 1S is a problem, but 3S is no problem. Okay, they use that to actually tune their accelerator and so forth and so on. So they're very familiar with running on the 3S, and that's a perfectly good approach to this whole business.
But then you have additional pions in there.
Yeah, but actually those are good because they allow you
yeah.
to tag the 1S
yeah.
if you want to do it that way.
Yeah.
And the branching ratio, even from the 3S to gamma A1, is similar to the branching ratio from the 1S. To gamma A1. Well, there are other remarks, but I won't go on with this. But it's an attractive scenario, and I think it should be taken seriously. Light Higgs in general should be taken seriously. And Upsilon decays are a good way to sort of push the limits on this kind of model. Okay, that's it.